Before starting today's episode, a quick message from today's episode sponsor, Bluegrass Retina Consultants. Bluegrass Retina Consultants is in Lexington, Kentucky. They are looking for a new surgical retina doctor. Come live in one of America's best mid-sized cities with amenities such as excellent schools, affordable living, central location with daily nonstop flights to 17 urban and beach destinations, a vibrant downtown culture, and a famous bluegrass natural beauty. The practice includes unmatched base salary, lucrative bonus and benefits, and fantastic schedule flexibility for a doctor wishing less than a full-time position. The ideal candidate will likely be 1 to 4 years post-fellowship and family-oriented, or else in mid-career seeking work-life balance. For more information, please contact Dr. Angelia Thompson at 859-333-7894. That's 859-333-7894.
Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreather. Today on episode 299, we come back with the traditional journal club. I'm joined by three retina specialists to discuss three recent articles applicable to all general ophthalmologists. We discuss articles looking at opioid use and opioid prescription patterns by ophthalmologists. We then delve into racial disparities in recruitment for clinical trials and end with an article discussing the COVID-19 telehealth experience. As always, you can find a list of financial disclosures for all retina specialists who participate on this podcast in the episode description. You can also find a link to click on to go to the American Academy of Ophthalmology website to get CME credits for this podcast episode and many other podcast episodes. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now back with a journal club, joined by three retina specialists for this journal club, covering articles published in major ophthalmology journals. We first have an alphabetical order. Dr. Avni Finn joining us from the Bay Area. Avni, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Jay.
Next, alphabetical order, Dr. M. Ali Khan joining us from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Ali.
Good to see you guys. Thanks for having me.
And last but not least, Dr. Priya Bakaria joining us from the DC area.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me.
I am post-red eye, so excited to do this. And here we go. So the first article we're going to talk about is called Persistent Opioid Use After Ophthalmic Surgery in Opioid-Naive Patients and Associated Risk Factors. Cindy Ung, who just joined a practice on the West Coast, is the first author on this paper, a friend of the program, Yoshihiro Yonakawa, second author on this paper. So let's talk a little bit about this article. What did they set out to show? And this article published in Ophthalmology just within the last month.
Yeah, so you know, the premise of this article was really that we're in an era where we have an increasing incidence of opioid use, and it's led to a national crisis. And the goal of this article was really to determine the rate and also the risk factors for persistent opioid use in ophthalmic surgery, and especially those patients who are opioid naive. And so in the study, they looked at this data using a private insurance claims database called the Optum database. And really looked at patients who were 13 years and older. They looked over a 7-year span, so 2010 to 2017, and looked at those patients that filled an opioid prescription within the perioperative period, so that they counted as 30 days before surgery and 3 days after surgery. And these patients were all opioid naive, as far as they could tell from the database. So they excluded any patients that had one or more opioid prescriptions within the prior year to 31 days before their surgery, so that they could best kind of get at those opioid naive patients. And then they also excluded any patients who had additional surgeries after their eye surgery. So any additional surgeries in that 6-month period after, patients who had like a greater than 1 month stay in the hospital or weren't discharged home, and then those that didn't have continuous insurance enrollment. And what they wanted to measure in the study was those who had persistent opioid use after they were initially prescribed opioids for their eye surgery. And so the way they defined persistent opioid use is that you had to have a prescription filled in the 90-day period after surgery, and then also another prescription filled in the 90 to 180 days after surgery. And if you didn't have a prescription during the perioperative period, but you did have one between 4 and 90 days after surgery, and also one 90 to 180 days that was also considered persistent opioid use. So what they found is that out of over 300,000 opioid naive patients that underwent eye surgery, there were 14,841 or 4.5% that filled an opioid prescription. Of these patients, 3.9% had what we considered persistent opioid use. So they continued to fill an opioid prescription after their initial prescription was given to them for eye surgery. And then they calculated some other data, which I felt was pretty meaningful. So they calculated what was called a morphine milligram equivalent, which basically tells us that a median of 100 morphine milligrams was prescribed per patient, which basically equates to about 13 5 milligram oxycodone pills. And patient risk factors for new persistent use were being age between 50 to 60 years old, female sex, Black race, having a lower household income, having an education less than a bachelor's degree, residence in the West and also in the South, a history of tobacco use, a history of anxiety and mood disorders, most interestingly, having an initial perioperative opioid prescription filled. So, I think that the conclusion of this article was that overall, as ophthalmologists, we have a very low rate of prescribing opioids. We're about 4% compared to kind of the national mean of 7% of all providers. But that initial opioid fill for an opioid naive patient was the risk factor with the highest odds ratio. So it gives you like a 6 times greater risk for persistent opioid use. And that perhaps eliminating that initial prescription could have the largest impact on reducing persistent opioid use following surgery. Overall, I think this was a really well-constructed study and gave us some meaningful insight into how our prescribing patterns affect patient behavior and contribute to the opioid crisis potentially long-term, and what we might be able to do to stratify risk for patients and decrease risk. But there, of course, are limitations. This, like many large studies, is a health insurance claims database. So it is limited by the constraints of the database. So it's limited only to private insurances. You can't get at the Medicare, Medicaid, and veterans who also, may suffer from the same sort of crisis. And you can't account for patients who showed up in the ER and got an opioid prescription there. And then kind of the look back period was just a year. So if a patient had a prior history of opioid use, you couldn't really catch those patients as well.
Great, great summary. This is a really interesting paper. I like papers that change management potentially, and also I learned something from it. And I don't know if you guys learned something from it, but I'll say personally, before I ask you, Priya, and then Ali, I think the rate is above what I would expect. I mean, I think now that I hear it and I think about it, and we have obviously an opiate dependence epidemic in this country. We've done like CME and all these adjusted guidelines and courses for licensure covering this, but 3% is not low for sustained use past the perioperative period. I mean, it's 1 out of 30. And if you operate as a retina surgeon on, let's say, 300 patients a year, if you're a busy surgeon, that's a lot of cases, but 300 patients, that's 10 patients in a year if you prescribe every single patient an opiate who's going to go on. And then that goes to our second question we get to later, is like, is there a patient you prescribe, and what setting do you prescribe, and how do you do that? But for first, Priya, are you surprised by these results? Like, you read this, did this higher than what you'd expect? Or am I just naive for thinking this is higher than I would expect?
I agree with you, Jay. I think this is a higher rate than I would expect. But I think that we all vary in our prescribing patterns. And this paper actually alluded to the fact that in a separate study in a healthcare claims database, there were 11 opioid prescriptions per year on average per retina specialist, but 6% of prescribers accounted for a third of the total opioid prescriptions for retina specialists. And so that shows that we vary a lot in terms of our prescribing patterns. So the rate is higher than what I would expect, but it could be that we grew up in this era of, you know, the opioid epidemic. And so our generation is a lot more reluctant to prescribe opioids, but that may not have been true in the past. And we're creatures of habit. We're used to doing medicine, we're used to practicing medicine the way that we've practiced it for years. And so that could account for some of that variability.
Yeah. And I think you mentioned creatures of habit. I think especially that comes with the post-operative medications. I think most surgeons, whether that it's in their head and they just write the same prescriptions every time mechanically, or whether they actually have pre-filled prescriptions that they automatically release either in advance of surgery with their scheduling team or after surgery, even if you're an epidemic institution with your fellows, there's these algorithms you kind of develop. So if you are in the algorithm of prescribing opiates, it's going to continue. And if you stop that algorithm, it's not going to be there. You know, Ali, I'll get your thoughts on what, how surprised you are. And we can kind of sign this next thing is like opiates and eye pain control, right? So obviously there's different ophthalmic surgeries, and this is a retina podcast. We can talk more about retinal surgery. I mean, one of the things I've always been taught, and maybe this is just cultural, and I find it true even when I see patients, is opiates aren't awesome, even in terms of like an actual efficacy manner in terms of controlling post-operative eye pain, whether you're talking about corneal issues, corneal abrasion, talking about some other sort of pain related to scleral buckle, for example, which is an uncomfortable surgery for some patients. High pressures of the eye, for example, can give pain. Opiates don't really control that. In fact, you kind of want to know if a patient's having pain related to eye pressure. I don't see many scenarios, at least as a retinal surgeon, where opiates are super useful or warranted for the majority of patients. But maybe I'm missing something here. And again, I'm focusing most on retina surgery because I'm sure there's other surgery, especially on the oculoplastic side, where it might be more warranted. But thoughts again on the rate, and then kind of let's talk a little about opiates and retinal surgery.
Yeah, I mean, I think you know, kind of what Priya mentioned about being in different eras. When we were fellows, Jay, we often prescribed opioids, like 5 tablets of Norco or something for any buccal patient, just because that was just what we did. And, you know, just in case the patient had pain, we wanted to have something available. And
I wasn't going to say anything if you didn't say
yeah,
anything.
And then all of a sudden, you know, we stopped doing that. And the increase call, there was no increase in calls for pain or anything. We even used to prescribe, you know, Zofran and other stuff like that too, as a routine. And I think once awareness came out that this is a problem, we sort of stopped doing that. And even if it was 5 tablets, you know, this paper kind of shows that maybe that's enough. And, you know, a big part of this paper, and they mentioned it, was that, you know, they used filling the prescription as a proxy for use. So, you know, there may be, you know, something, you know, not necessarily 100% correct in what we can conclude, because we don't, they just held on after they just filled it just to have it available. But I think it goes to show that, you know, just randomly prescribing these medications wasn't the right move. And maybe it's still appropriate in individual cases and people with a history of chronic pain or other conditions that you would maybe work along with a pain management doctor, but just sort of indiscriminate use just in case people have pain, you know, clearly I don't think it's needed. And we kind of know that now. And I personally haven't had any issues since we graduated fellowship with pain for retinal surgery.
Yeah. And Avni, let's bring it back to you. Again, I think one of the things I was taught is just like, you don't want to suppress. So I think pain control from the perspective of the patient, it's challenging, right? Because often the recovery nurses are saying, well, don't take any non-steroidals, right? You don't want to take anything potentially influence bleeding. And again, we can argue how important that is. It probably varies depending on the surgery you're doing. If you're doing an epiretinal membrane peel that was uncomplicated and short versus you did a 3-hour diabetic TRD juicy dissection, maybe it matters, maybe it doesn't, if you take NSAIDs or not. Yes, you can always get hemorrhagic choroidal detachment, something bad, but like oftentimes patients said, hey, you can take Tylenol, and Tylenol isn't sufficient, then call your doctor. And so I think that's sometimes where there's that jump to, hey, if you're having discomfort, take an opiate. And again, I just think mechanistically, you'll do better with an anti-inflammatory than with just simply a pain control measure. And so I don't know. I have a lower threshold than some people to allow patients, especially post-buccal, to start taking NSAIDs. Obviously, I give them limits, and there's obviously someone's going to come up with a story and email me afterwards saying that, hey, I had a patient take 15 ibuprofen in the span of 3 days, and they bled, and they got like a you know, retrovulvar hemorrhage or something horrible. But like, but I just try to think logically. There are better ways. And in fact, you probably, even though you don't want that phone call while you're having dinner with your family on a Thursday night after you operated on Wednesday, you probably want to know if a patient's having such significant pain that it's better off checking them, because there's some dangerous things it could be. It could be a high pressure, it could be choroidals, it could be something that you want to be aware of. So I don't know. What do you typically do? So what do you do in terms of pain management of your patients? What's your threshold to start NSAIDs and versus an opiate? Is there a scenario where you will prescribe an opiate for a patient?
Yeah, I routinely almost never prescribe opioids. I actually like haven't prescribed any in the last 2 years. But that also is a change, like you guys were talking about, from fellowship. You know, in my second year of fellowship, there was this big focus on not prescribing opioids. And so changing how we manage pain for patients. And I find that actually really just talking the patient through what the next couple of days are going to feel like, especially a buccal patient, helps a tremendous amount in them understanding and managing their pain. I, like you, have a really low threshold for non-steroidals. So I'll tell them to alternate extra strength Tylenol and ibuprofen. I give them a good additional block at the end of a surgery, especially when I've done a buccal. And I find that those things combined with, you know, after taking the patch off, sometimes doing some ice, really helps control the pain. And most patients are totally fine. You know, the first 24 to 48 hours can be a little bit rough, but after that, they're, as long as you've talked them through the things that they can do and to manage the pain, most patients I find really don't need anything additional to that. And I think one thing in the study that kind of alluded to that was that most of the patients who were prescribed opioids for trauma, strabismus, and retinal surgery, which we think of could be potentially the most kind of disruptive or painful surgeries, filled their prescriptions, but there was a lower rate of persistent opioid use with those surgeries compared to anterior segment surgery. Which was interesting to me. And I'm not completely sure how to interpret that. I'd be interested to hear what you guys thought. But, you know, anterior segment corneal stuff to me does not also does not respond well to opioids. And so, you know, I think that there are other measures that can be taken to ease the pain for most of these patients.
Great. Any last points on this article?
So the one other thing that I thought was interesting that surprised me was the dose of opioids was also not necessarily associated with less dependence. So they reference here other specialty studies and showed that less than 200 of a morphine milligram equivalent is what the recommended dose is. But in this study, patients routinely had less than that dose. They routinely had about 100 to 150 and still showed this opioid persistent opioid use. And so even the dose of opioids is not necessarily going to influence whether or not you have a patient who has persistent use, but it's more, as Avni and Ali mentioned, that initial prescription.
Great point. Really, really good point. So let's move on from this discussion, kind of a surgically oriented discussion. Let's talk about clinical trials. So this was an article published in JAMA Ophthalmology. The title is Racial Ethnic Disparities in Ophthalmology Clinical Trials, resulting in U.S. Food and Drug Administration drug approvals from 2000 to 2020. Sriji Patel, a friend of the program, was senior author. Sean Berkowitz, one of his stellar med students, first author in this paper. Sean recently graduated from Vanderbilt. And so this was published April 22nd. Tell us a little bit about this article, and then we can dive into discussion.
All right. So again, another shout out to Sriji and Sean for this article, which I thought was, you know, not only timely, but, you know, very well done. What they basically did was looked at any U.S. Food and Drug Administration approvals from 2000 to 2020, and looked at the racial and gender distributions within those clinical trials and compared them to what would be expected enrollment based on population data. So looking at actual NEI data for the disease prevalence in our different racial and ethnic subgroups and comparing them to what our trials actually enrolled. They compared these in medication approvals for AMD, diabetic retinopathy, and glaucoma, and then looked at the 20-year period into two periods, the first 10 versus the latter 10, to see if there's any changes. And you know, what they found was that of the trials they looked at, which were 31 clinical trials, which resulted in approval of 13 medications, that the trials that led to approval were mismatched from expected population data in 12 of the 13 medications and in gender for 10 of the 13 medications. Comparing the first decade versus the second decade, they did notice that there was some improvement in enrollment of underrepresented minorities, with increases in enrollment of Asian, Hispanic, or Latinx participants, and in AMD, increase in Asian participants for diabetic retinopathy, and increase in Black and Hispanic populations for glaucoma. However, over that similar time frame, there was a decrease in Black participants for diabetic retinopathy. So, you know, some improvement, but then some steps back. And looking forward to population data for 2030 and 2050, they estimated that this enrollment disparity is going to get worse. So I think proving, you know, with data what a lot of us sort of already expected to see from these clinical trials, and spent a good amount of their discussion kind of very thoughtfully going over some major points. A few of those being, one, how they noticed it was difficult to even describe some groups. You know, Hispanic versus Latinx changed during this 20-year period, and thus you can't necessarily compare the groups longitudinally over that time. You know, what is ethnic versus what is race, how we've had that evolve over time, particularly related to the Hispanic Latinx population. They talked about how population studies can actually boost enrollment by bringing awareness of disease prevalence. So they referenced the Los Angeles Latino Eye Study, which looked at glaucoma at USC, and how after publication of that study, enrollment of Hispanic and Latinx participants in glaucoma trials increased, perhaps because people were more aware of glaucoma in that population. And they also noticed, you know, the effect of potentially pooling international data, how Asian participants may be enrolling higher because they're including enrolled participants from other countries. And does that really represent what's happening in an Asian population in the US? So a lot of different things that can be thought about. And they also mentioned that, you know, these drugs really help. So, you know, we also have to balance this need to properly enroll, you know, different racial and ethnic subgroups with also the ease of getting these medications approved quickly. And we all as a community, you know, within retina and glaucoma and, you know, and all ophthalmology clinical trials need to figure out ways to boost enrollment and do that well. And I guess that's, you know, the more difficult question, but I think this paper really sets the stage for that kind of discussion for the next, you know, 20 years, as they mentioned, if our trends continue to hold true, our disparities are only going to get worse.
Great summary. And I think this is something we talk about a lot of clinical trials in this podcast. We just recorded a journal club last week talking about clinical trials. And it's always fascinating to look at the demographics table. It's usually table one in most of these papers. And most of the time people gloss over it. They're just like, okay, the groups matched, move on. If the groups are matched, if it's a diabetic study, okay, how long have they been diabetic? What's the A1C? But it's remarkable how often the percentage of white versus non-white study subjects is drastically different, right? I mean, most of the trials to my head, and that matches what we saw here, which is actually quantifying it, it's upwards of 80%, you know, for most of these trials. And that does not, as you said, represent accurately, neither the state of the US population or where it's going, but more importantly, the patients who get these disease conditions. So I think this is a great article to quantify this. They talk a little bit in the discussion about kind of ways to improve this. So I guess what I'm saying is I'm not that surprised by the results of this. It just kind of confirms what anecdotally I think a lot of us have observed. But Avni, again, are you surprised at all by this? And let's talk a little bit about, well, if you say, okay, this is a goal, how do you make this a goal when you're designing a trial? Because I think trial recruitment is already so difficult and it's so painful sometimes to kind of find the right subject, the right person who's going to be motivated to come and do the visits and meets all the study criteria. I mean, we don't really have studies in general, unless it's specifically written, like you referenced Ali, the Latino eye study, unless it's like written into the protocol, hey, you know, we're looking for persons of X background. It's not like most of our diabetic macular edema or AMD trials are saying, hey, we need X amount of people of this background, X amount of people of that background. That really hasn't been the standard in retina. Is that a solution? Or if that isn't a solution, what are kind of solutions to make this more equal? Because I don't know, maybe you could argue it's not a problem, but I think it is a problem when your trial results don't necessarily reflect the real world population you're treating.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. I think it is a problem, and it's important for studies like this to point out and study those inequalities, because it's the only way for us to kind of bring to light those differences and actively address them. And we know it's a problem because we know, like, other studies have looked at, for example, DME in Black patients and how comparing them to other racial groups, their vision improves less. And so, you know, getting more data on whether there are racial or ethnic differences on how patient populations respond to certain drugs or certain treatments is important, and enrolling more people of different races and ethnic backgrounds in clinical trials is one excellent way for us to get that data. So I think it's really important to bring to light. I think a few things kind of related to your question about, you know, the challenges of recruiting a patient population in a clinical trial that adequately reflects the normal patient population. They allude to some of these things in the paper, but there is some underlying fear and mistrust of clinical trials and studies among minority racial groups. And so that's something that needs to be addressed on a more systemic level. There's a huge problem of health literacy, right? So a lot of these trials don't have translators. They don't have consents in multiple different languages. And so there's that problem of actually helping your patient to understand what a clinical trial means, what it means for them to be enrolled in a clinical trial, but that they're not going to get like a placebo medication or no treatment by enrolling in a clinical trial. And that all takes time and additional resources that a lot of times you don't get provided with by a pharmaceutical company or during a clinical trial. And then kind of the last thing I think I've personally been faced with when trying to enroll some patients is that the exclusion criteria for some of the goals, particularly in the diabetic retinopathy studies, are limiting. So you have to have a pretty strict A1C for a lot of trials. You have to have a pretty strict blood pressure control. You know, you can't have glaucoma that's on multiple medications. So there are these barriers to potentially enrolling patients who already might not have as good access to healthcare or as well controlled disease. And so those set a different set of barriers to just even helping your patient understand a trial and enroll in it.
Yeah. And those strict criteria are interesting, right? Because from a scientific perspective, you can say that makes sense. We're trying to eliminate confounders. We really want to isolate the drug's effect. But from a practical perspective, the company that's writing the protocol, approving these protocols, also they want the drug to work, right? So you don't want to apply it to a population that maybe theoretically or practically less likely to work in. So then you try. That's why we always look at these diabetic trials and we're like, okay, the A1C does not match the average A1Cs or clinic. We talked about that when we talked about all the DRCR trials, which are not pharmaceutically sponsored. But we also talked about when we talk about pharmaceutically sponsored trials like Panorama or other trials. So Priya, your thoughts on this issue? And again, are there sort of ways you can think that we would be able to improve this? Or, I mean, they are showing it's improving over time. So again, there's a lot of times the argument for any sort of disparities trial, like, hey, if it's improving over time, it will organically sort of fix itself. Do you think there's a need to accelerate this change?
I mean, I think that having trials reflect the general population is always going to be better, because then we know how to apply that data to our patients. This paper alludes to the fact of that being difficult. I mean, it is difficult to enroll in these trials, and these trials are oftentimes a very time-sensitive manner. And so one of the things this paper alludes to is, I think they said, describing how underrepresented the population in this study is. So having like an underrepresentation scale that's reported on each study so that you know how applicable that is to your general population. And also this brings to light how important post-market analysis is. You know, it's very important once these drugs come to market to continue to look at them, to apply it to your population, to know how effective it is. I think, you know, to answer your question, Jay, of course, you know, we want to get our trials to be as diverse and as inclusive as possible. And I hope that with time and with greater, with more people being aware of this issue, that will happen. But in the short term, I think it's important to just recognize that these trials don't always represent our patient population and to maybe include something in each trial about how representative the population is.
Ali, any final points on your end about the study?
No, I would just say, even when we try to, enroll according to population estimates, Asian is pretty diverse. You know, this is like Team South Asia on this podcast right now, but Asian is like a very
unintentionally. I mean, I feel bad actually. It was unintentional.
Very, very big group. Hispanic Latinx is not a homogenous group. Black is not a homogenous group. So even when we do enroll, it's still more complicated than what it seems. So I think the do better is the take home message I take home with, and it's not simple. And I think it's worthwhile looking at solutions for it. And I don't know how many of us would be able to convince our own parents to join a clinical trial, but I think I would have a hard time. So, I think there's work to do on a lot of different ends, but worthwhile in the end.
So let's move on to our last paper. And our last paper touches on a subject we have talked about a lot, which is telemedicine and COVID-19. So this was called Telehealth-Based Eye Care During the COVID-19 Pandemic, Utilization, Safety, and the Patient Experience. Paula Ann Newman Casey, the first author, and Maria Woodward, shout out. She was senior author on this as well as an opioid paper. Didn't mention that earlier. Maria, do you just want to run us through this paper and what they showed?
Yeah, absolutely. So this was a cross-sectional study that looked at patients during the shelter at home order in Michigan, specifically at the University of Michigan. So this was a 2-month period of a shelter at home in the spring of 2020 during the COVID-19 pandemic. And the purpose of this study is to mainly look at patient satisfaction, 3 different forms of care, whether that's in-person, telehealth, or a phone-based call, or even deferred visits. And they looked at patient satisfaction with care, patient safety, and the patient's perception about their eyesight and if they were worried about their eyesight. And so during this time period of the shelter at home, there were about 3,274 patients who had a visit, whatever that visit might have been, and about 53% agreed to participate in the survey. And these were patients who, again, had either in-person, video call, telephone visits, or had one of those 3 visits, or had a rescheduled visit. And they were asked one of 3 questions. First, how do you feel about coming to clinic during the coronavirus pandemic? Or how did you feel about having your virtual visit? Or how did you feel about having a rescheduled visit? And then they were also asked, how worried were you about your eyesight and how satisfied were you with the care that you received? All of the patients were called within a few weeks of their visit or their rescheduled visit. And basically a team looked at their results. And so basically in-person participants were significantly older than telephone visits and older than video call visits as well. This was statistically significant in comparison to both of those groups. More white participants had in-person visits than minority patients. When they looked at different subspecialties, retina specialists were more likely to do in-person visits and cornea specialists were more likely to do telephone visits. Again, that was statistically significant. And in-person participants overall worried more about their eyesight than those who had telephone, video call, or deferred visits. Out of all the visits, in general, not a high percentage resulted in, so out of all the telehealth visits, not a high percentage resulted in in-person visits. Only 1.5% resulted in an in-person visit in a day, 2.9% within 2 to 7 days, and 2.4% within 8 to 14 days. And so in summary, what this group found was that when appropriately triaged, telehealth visits are a safe way to reduce volume of in-person visits and to promote social distancing in clinic, and that it is still a useful adjunct to our normal care. And overall, patients were pretty satisfied with their care when it was triaged through the system during this shelter at home.
Great summary. And again, I think it's an important article to quantify the experiences many people had during a critical time period. I think that we've talked about this before, but I think that this is useful. I also think it's really tough to extrapolate everything from people's impressions and perceptions during the stay-at-home period of the pandemic and whether that extrapolates to their perceptions all the time when they're not in a pandemic setting. And what I'm driving at is, we talked about this during the pandemic, is I think that in the setting of a pandemic, when there's a lot of fear and there's a lot of uncertainty, I think patients especially, many were just grateful to get any sort of care, which was good if you're a healthcare provider. They're just, you know, they wanted to get seen, they wanted to take care of. I think a lot more patients were amenable, at least in my experience, to telehealth visits. I think there are still some patients who have become comfortable with that and prefer it. And I think it depends on the scenario. I don't think all of the patients who responded, yes, I prefer this, still feel that way, because now that they're back in like more feeling more safe, more normal, if they're vaccinated, they actually still prefer to kind of go back to the way it was. So maybe I would view this as maybe the study overestimates, that'd be my guess, the percentage of patients who are satisfied with this form of healthcare delivery. But Ali, I'd love to get your impressions and thoughts on the paper, and then you can tell the listeners if you think what I thought was crazy and zany, or if you agree.
I think, like you said, it's helpful to kind of get a patient's perspective on the whole process, because we, you know, often focus on our perspective, which, as on a Retina podcast, I think most of us would say was not great in terms of definitely telephone calls, but also in video calls, especially as they highlight in the paper with the lack of, you know, ancillary testing. So, you know, this paper, similar to many of the telehealth papers, didn't look at necessarily outcomes, sort of, you know, what was missed, what was not missed, which I think obviously is, you know, really important. But at least this kind of sets the stage that at least, you know, patients seem to be, you know, happy with it. And it did result in low rates of, you know, very urgent visits coming in a primarily anterior segment population. So, you know, the big takeaway I took was kind of the opinions that even the patients were most concerned about the lack of ancillary testing. You know, they mentioned that in discussion. And I think, you know, moving forward, now that things are reopening, I think that hybrid model where you have maybe remote ancillary testing and then kind of a video visit to sort of interpret those results might be, you know, something that has legs for people with maybe stable diseases that, you know, don't need, you know, monthly injections or that sort of thing. But I think, you know, I'd be interested in seeing publications about that model in particular and compare the outcomes. And I think that would actually be the most kind of substantive and convincing, at least in my perspective. But, you know, I think as things open up, maybe that's a little bit tougher to do.
Yeah. And before, Avni, I'm going to get your thoughts. I mean, Ali, my follow-up question would be like, how long a study and how long would the outcomes have to be for you to like to get a meaningful difference? It just depends on the disease. If you're talking about like dry AMD, diabetic retinopathy, I feel like you need a few years to kind of get a sense, or outcomes improved or not. And then you have to be sure that you're capturing all the patients that maybe you did a televisit for. Are they all coming back to you if they have a problem? Are they going somewhere else? But I agree. I mean, I agree with what you're saying. I'm just curious, like, what you would think. What would that publication look like in terms of how long would the outcomes have to be?
I think most people would start with non-actively managed diseases like dry AMD or something like that. You know, even perhaps even post-retinal detachment repair that's been stable, you know, do they need to really come in, or can you do, you know, wide field imaging and that sort of thing and see if with an OCT, if there's anything going on. I think that seems reasonable. Some of these visits that we see for a routine follow-up are pretty quick. And I think a lot of the data that we analyze are the ancillary tests, as long as their vision seems okay. And I think maybe I would probably start with those conditions. And then I wouldn't think you needed too much long-term data on that, because honestly, not a whole lot is changing. But kind of for the actively managed diseases, that's a little tougher, because at some point you're gonna need somebody to do the injection. So what's the point of doing it hybrid if they're gonna need something done anyway? So I think you maybe have to separate out the diagnoses and go from there. And that's, you know, obviously in terms of retina, glaucoma, and you know, other conditions, are it's a little different.
Yeah. Until the Amazon drone comes and injects you at your house, then I'll be okay. Avni, your thoughts on this paper, telehealth, COVID-19, post-COVID-19, what's been your experience?
You know, I think it's helpful for a study like this to help us quantify how patients felt about their visits during a time when you know, there weren't a lot of options and a lot of visits had to be canceled. And I think the other helpful thing about this paper is that they were able to quantify in some way whether patients felt appropriately triaged as well. And also nice to see, you know, what patients preferred. So most patients preferred the in-person or face visit with a video call rather than a telephone call. So it does go to show that patients do like that human interaction. And even during a time when that was limited, valued that, which kind of goes along with what you were saying earlier, Jay, like, you know, how much do patients value this just during the pandemic when there are other extenuating circumstances, and how much are they going to want a normal visit where they can meet with their doctor and get their normal testing, which Ali alluded to, and see their doctors and get their eye examination. I think there were even a couple of quotes in here about patients saying, you know, it was the telehealth visit was nice and it was fine during that limited period of time, but I really wanted an eye examination, and that you can't really do that on a video call. And especially, you know, they talk about how the visits were much less amenable to retina patients, where we do a lot of imaging and testing, which really drives our decision-making more than talking to our patients sometimes. And so I agree with what all of you have said, that studying the outcomes is really important and helpful, especially when studying different modes of delivering care. I think studying these hybrid models like they did, I thought was pretty interesting, the like drive-through eye care tonometry testing in this study. It would have been nice to see some data on, you know, how those glaucoma patients did. Was that helpful? Was that not, you know, kind of a helpful test to get along the way? Did it change any outcomes for those patients? Were they able to kind of, you know, monitor them stably? I think that would have been something nice. And I'm looking for, I think, more data on kind of like a hybrid model, because I think as we develop new technology with home OCT monitoring and other ways to measure visual acuity and keep track of things at home, it would be nice to know if adapting our care really makes sense for our patients.
I started laughing for those watching the video, because we did do the drive-through tonometry here. I can't say it was a resounding success. I don't know. And glaucoma people already don't love tonometry with the tonopen anyway.
That's true.
I feel like if you went to glaucoma person, they would be like, well, if a tonopen measures a falling tree in the forest pressure, did anyone really check the pressure? I mean, like, it's just ironic because they started doing that for like these glaucoma patients, but most of the glaucoma attendings, at least here, don't like the tonopen for checking their pressure. So it's, but anyway, drive-through tonometry is definitely a work in progress, though it is an interesting concept. Ali, Priya, any other thoughts on this issue before we break?
No, I mean, I think it was a great study that, you know, I think we're all glad to put the pandemic behind us. Hopefully we don't have another pandemic in our lifetime, but, you know, it goes to show that the thing I'm most impressed with is how well retina specialists and ophthalmologists adapted to this situation that was, as we all know, confusing and scary. And it just goes to show that we can do some telehealth visits if needed. I don't think our specialty is going to adopt it as widely as other specialties, such as dermatology or specialties where you can kind of visualize things better on a camera platform. But I think that, you know, medicine is changing, and we can never rule out that telehealth will become a much wider part of our practice in the future.
Well, thank you guys for joining this podcast. Avni Finn, Emali Khan, Priya Vakharia, thanks for taking the time to discuss it. Shout out to Priya Vakharia, new baby. Middle name is almost Jay. Almost snuck it in there. Didn't quite get there. Shout out to Dr. Avni Finn, second baby on the way in 2 weeks. Is that correct?
Yes.
So actually, by the time this podcast releases, that will already happen, because this is in the time vortex where things are going to happen already by the time this releases. Shout out to not Emali Khan, but Emali Khan's wife. And shout out to Mama Sridhar, who turned 64 on Thursday, raised 5 kids and is turning 64. So she's in a Beatles song now. All right, guys. Thank you, guys. Have a wonderful night.
Yep.
Have a good night.
Good night. Bye, everyone.
See ya.
As always, you can find this podcast episode and many other podcast episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. You're going to find all podcast episodes there, sorted by category and searchable. In addition, you can find a link that will help you subscribe and receive updates on episodes as they release in your inbox. Remember that we are in the Apple Store as well as in the Google Podcast app on your Android device. And you can also find us on Facebook and on Twitter at Retina Podcast. You can contact us by clicking on the contact us link on our website or emailing us directly at retinapodcast@gmail.com. Many thanks to doctors Avni Finn, Priya Vakaria, and Ali Khan for joining me. Thank you to doctors Louis Kai, Angela Chang, and Mike Benicasa for all their help as always with the podcast. And thank you, listeners, for the articles you read and publish, the conversations you inspire here, and the patients you take care of each week. This is Jay Schreeder, signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.